You are listening to the Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2017 Leadership Advance Conference, Telling the Story, Telling Your Story. The first general session was led by Andy Crouch of the John Templeton Foundation.
So RSWR, co-director of this film, Ride in Grace, thank you for submitting it and sharing it with us, sharing the story. How did you find this story? I mean, were you looking for a horseback rider in gang neighborhoods just anywhere in the country and just pick this one, or how'd you find it?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, as a documentary filmmaker in this political age, you're like, I'm looking for a white male Christian with a kind of a savior complex type of idea, you know, just to be honest. But we did, the two of us, Dane's not here, but we were like, we want somebody who's has a connection to a place and that is doing something sort of surreal and magical in a way, because I think after being in a documentary film school, you get kind of tired of the things that are almost too real and that aren't showing the magic in life, and you want to be like, I know it's there somewhere. So we actually specifically were asking people, is there anyone doing anything just almost like not real life? And so we reached out to some people, and they're like, there's this guy, you have to go talk to him. So we met up in a Denny's, and he just told us his life story and was totally open.
And how did you know this was, once you met him, that this was the story you wanted to tell?
I mean, it's hard to beat a man riding around the horse for the last 25 years of his life, just about every single day. So,
wow.
But yeah, he's also just a very, very open person. He was pretty excited about the whole thing too.
I learned something from watching the video. I looked at the Bible he was reading and I froze the frame, because I was like, that does not look like English. And I had to Google. It was not a language I recognized. It's actually Hmong. I assume he's a white American, but he's reading a Hmong Bible because he started out, I guess, working among the Hmong community. And so even in the course of watching the video, I learned things about him that you don't emphasize, you don't kind of dwell on that. What else did you learn in the course of making this that you didn't anticipate at the beginning?
You can't tell a whole life, right? I mean, it's a 7-minute video. In a short film, you have to just choose what you're going to focus on. Yeah. And his life is so complicated. I mean, he has a very broken and beautiful past. He's worked on the streets for years. Yeah, he worked with the Hmong refugee community. That's what he was working with, kids, and that his kid kept seeing them being swept up into drug-affiliated things and gangs, and so he got really upset about that and wanted to do something more about it, and had this dream. He started on a bike. So many things about him. I think also I learned that I could never capture someone's life in a film, you know, so you just have to decide kind of which question are you going to pull out, and also that you can't, it's hard to tell history. Images are present tense most of the time, so you have to show the current conflict. So I was actually more interested in a lot of his past conflicts.
Yeah.
But then we discovered, like, his current conflict is looking back and saying, you know, was my life sacrifice worth anything? Was I willing to... Did this make a difference? He wasn't really sure, you know? So that was a more interesting tension than maybe some of the other things we could have tried to do and recollect and make it a bit more nostalgic or something.
Right. You did this as part of the MFA in film at Stanford. As you kind of alluded to initially, this is probably not the most typical topic for a student film. But what does make this, I don't know if you'll like this question or not, but what makes this kind of a Stanford-worthy film? From your teachers and fellow students' point of view, when they look at this, what would they see that you put into it that makes it really a worthy act of storytelling at that level? Does that make sense as a question?
Oh, well, I hope it's worthy.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you for watching it. But I think that at Stanford, one thing they're not a journalism film program, like a lot of documentary journalism programs. They're pushing you to not necessarily be message-driven, to really just go beyond some things that I was, hearing, I think, will be talked about during this this time, beyond the problem solution type of framework, beyond like, here's this guy, he saw this problem, now he's gonna fix it, but to really push into what is his personal crisis, or what's the crisis you're gonna focus on, what is that tension that's gonna unlock something more vulnerable that can help people access the complexity of the situation. So, I mean, there's a lot of things about Tony. I mean, we had 17 hours of footage, just a 7-minute film. Yeah. I could have shown a totally different character. Huh. And so I think, you know, we just had to try to get people into a little bit of his world. And I don't know that we fully would endorse everything that he's doing even. And so I think that's also, it taught me that you have to have a certain type of empathy when you're dealing with real people as well. And I mean, in fiction as well, but to take a step back and just let it be a little bit.
Wow. Well, thank you for letting him be in a way that we got to experience.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Congratulations. We'll get to hear from another director this afternoon. You'll see two more of these stories, really quite extraordinary ones that won the top three places. And then tonight, we have three more honorable mention films that you get to watch if you stick around after dessert. I think there's dessert to entice you to stick around, actually. And I got to watch all six of them, and it is really extraordinary the kinds of short, powerful films and stories that are being made and told. I get to be with you today, this afternoon, again. Tomorrow we'll have more of a conversation, but what I want to do today is talk about story and give you a way of understanding what this thing is. When we say telling your story, telling the gospel story, what do we mean when we say story? So that my agenda this morning is to just give you a framework in a way for what you just saw, or at least put what you just saw in context and explain how story works as best as I can explain it in a short amount of time. And then this afternoon we're going to look more deeply at the gospel story in particular, the story that has been entrusted to Christian people to tell, and in a way to our organizations insofar as they're part of that story. What's the gospel story about? The context for all of this, I think, is that we are in a real story crisis in the West, I would dare to say. That in this kind of late modern moment, the stories that we've told ourselves and the way we have told stories is breaking down in pretty significant ways. All the influential stories of our times are dystopias, are stories of disillusionment. I was writing a book review the other day about institutions, and I was thinking about all the institutions portrayed in the stories that are part of what we think of as the golden age of television in the last 15 or 20 years. Whether it's Mad Men, or House of Cards, or Game of Thrones, or Breaking Bad, the stories we have over and over being told in the most influential and the most excellent ways are stories of disillusionment, breakdown, disappointment, dead ends. And I think this reflects something that's happening in our culture. I think we had an American story at one time, and I think it tracked very closely with a biblical story called the Exodus, the idea of escaping oppression, arriving at a promised land, making the most of that land. This was the story adopted by the people who became the majority culture of this country, the Anglo-Americans, European-Americans who settled this country, adopted a kind of Exodus story. But it was also the dominant story or the guiding story for many minority communities within this country. Not all, but many adopted this kind of model of Exodus. And I think everyone feels like this story of arrival in some kind of promised land has ground to a halt. And so the stories we now tell ourselves are exile stories, are stories of frustration, of waiting. And when it gets detached from Christian commitment and detached from some sense of a God still active even in exile, you end up with dystopia. Hunger Games, basically anything your kids are reading, it's bad news these days. There's two problems from our point of view, I think, as leaders of endeavors to serve our neighbors and the world. There's two problems with this kind of turn to disillusioned, dystopic stories. One is a very practical one. No one seems to know how to finish these stories, right? So no one knows how to write a good ending Lost, a very influential television show of the late 1990s, it was kind of one of the first really impressive new attempts at narrative, just totally gave up at the end and just decided we aren't even going to try to end this story. Just, you know, pull the ripcord and eject. Breaking Bad, very, very controversial, whether that ending really did justice to its incredible tortured story of a chemistry teacher who hopefully never got any Murdoch funding for his equipment. George Martin is never going to finish Game of Thrones. He's absolutely ground to a halt. This story of generation after generation of betrayal in this in these kingdoms of this mythical land. He does not know how to get his story to an ending that would satisfy even him, let alone his millions of readers. And maybe the deeper problem is once you've read these stories, what do you build? What do you do with your life? It leaves you with nothing to do with your life. And yet, I think the people who are in this room are part of organizations that still have a sense of mission and purpose and real calling to the world that does make a difference. Now, we surely all of us have our moments where we wonder, am I the bird whose wings are going to stop flapping? And what happens after that bird's wings stop flapping? And we sit on our beds and wonder about our lives. But we get up the next morning animated by something other than pure dystopian disillusionment. So I don't think an adequate ending or an adequate future is just going to emerge from our culture's current poverty of story. I do think that the organizations and the missions and the people in this room could be part of offering our neighbors a story that's so much better than the ones we've figured out how to tell so far. And that's really the goal of these 2 days, to leave you with more of an ability to tell a compelling, true, truthful, hopeful story based on what your life and mission have shown you. To do that, I am going to attempt in the next roughly 30 minutes to give you a full account of how stories work, and I'm going to do it using a French structuralist. His name was Aige Grémat. He wrote a book called Dusson in 1970 that was quoted in a little green paperback that I ran across halfway through my seminary training in Boston. It was a little PhD reprint. Any of you who have spent time around graduate schools have seen the Minnesota series of reprints of doctoral dissertations. They are the most boring-looking possible books, these kind of pale green paperbacks that are just facsimiles of TypeScript on the inside, or at least they were back in the 1990s when I was in seminary. But I ran across this one Minnesota reprint of a doctoral dissertation by an unknown Yale PhD student named Richard Hayes, who went on to be one of the most eminent New Testament scholars of his generation. But back then, he was just a pale green paperback. That's all he was to me. And his doctoral dissertation was called The Faith of Jesus Christ. Ended up being a tremendously influential piece of work within New Testament theology and New Testament scholarship. But what I took away from it was just a beautiful, simple picture of what a story is that Hayes had borrowed from Aige Grémat. What is a story? It basically has always this structure. It's about a sender trying to get an object to a receiver. There's somebody who wants something delivered. That's the basic template of story. The sender has something that needs to get somewhere, and to do that, the sender employs or deploys or commissions a subject. The traditional protagonist of a story is, in Grémat's terms, the subject of a narrative. And the subject's job is to get the object to the receiver. Along the way, the subject is helped by people we will, in very technical French terms, call helpers. And then this mission to get the object to the receiver also meets with opposition. So, the classic archetypal story of our time, I think, is Lord of the Rings, right? So what's the object in Lord of the Rings? This is like film theory 404, so I don't know if you'll be able to get it, but what's the object in Lord of the Rings? The ring! Ha! Wow, cool, okay. What's the receiver? Where does the ring need to go? Do you remember? Mount Doom, right? Where it was originally forged, where it must again be destroyed, lest its power take over the whole world. Who is the sender? Who seeks to get the ring to Mount Doom? A lot of the time, I think the most common answer is Gandalf. And in some way, Gandalf is the answer. Gandalf is the one who sets that plan in motion and sees that it must be done. But behind Gandalf, and this is one of the fascinating things about Lord of the Rings, it never spells this out, but there's some benevolent force in the cosmos that seeks to right the wrong that was created when the ring was forged with its dream of power. And so lurking behind Gandalf, and it's very often the case that this sender is a quasi-divine, quasi-godlike figure, sometimes never even on stage in the story. But you have this sense that there's kind of an ultimate commission from some ultimate source, perhaps mediated through a figure like Gandalf. Who's the subject who needs to get the ring to Mount Doom? Frodo Baggins, the Hobbit. I will take the ring, though I do not know the way. Along the way, he's got opponents. Don't need to enumerate those, but orcs, goblins, other various kinds of baleful creatures. And then he has, on the other hand, helpers. Above all, his trusted companion, Sam Gamgee. The gardener who comes along, but also Pippin and Merry and the other small people who go with them. This is the structure of story. A subject needs to fulfill a commission to get something where it's supposed to go, aided by helpers, opposed by opponents. And every time you tell a story, you use this structure. I needed to get to Portland last night. For some reason, my boarding pass hadn't printed out, or it didn't show up on my phone the way that I expect my boarding passes to now. And I was halfway here. I was in Dallas, and I could not get on the plane, but a very kind American Airlines agent printed out a boarding pass for me. I just told you a story. The sender wants to get Andy to Portland. All right, the sender is this godlike figure named Steve Moore, who has sort of called for me to make this trip. The subject is also me. I'm trying to get me there. My opponent is the American Airlines app, which is often my opponent, I find. Apps are often opponents these days. And my helper is that kind American Airlines agent. That's the structure of story. Every time you tell a story, this is the story you tell. But the fascinating thing that Grandma did is he said, when you really tell a complete story, you don't just tell this sequence once. I just told you a little mini story of getting to Portland, but honestly, if I had not used it as an illustration, you would have found it so unbelievably tedious to have me tell you that little thing and then move on. It didn't excite you, did it? When you didn't feel the conflict that I felt about my boarding pass, right? It was just this inert little moment. And you kind of got, oh yeah, Andy needed to get to Portland. But it had no power for you because it's not a complete story. It has the structure of a story. But Grandma says you actually have to tell this story, this sequence, 3 times before it really becomes a complete story. So what are the 3 times? Well, I'm going to illustrate this using one of the great movies of our time, the Disney Pixar film Ratatouille. Now, I am afraid some of you have not seen Ratatouille. I am going to entirely spoil Ratatouille for you now. You are going to know everything about the story except all the delightful twists and turns of the way it actually works. So you really can still watch it. The other thing I'm afraid of is that you haven't watched it because you think it's a children's movie and you might not have children or be at that stage, in which case you do not realize what you're missing. Because the golden age of Pixar, the roughly 10 or 15 years in which they made films, including Ratatouille, these are so much more than kids' movies. And Ratatouille, how many of you have seen it? Let me just see a show of hands. Fortunately, almost all of you. Actually, let's properly shame those of you. No, I'm just kidding. But if you haven't seen it, you really must, because it's a beautiful, beautiful film. It's ultimately like all Pixar films, about what it is to be a human being. Except this time, it's about a rat. So here's how story works. And so the way this is going to work is we're going to have 3 acts. Each of them is going to have the structure of sender, object, receiver, subject, helpers, opponents. And here's how it's going to work in Ratatouille. In Ratatouille, we are going to meet Remy, a rat. Remy desires to be a chef, an unlikely calling for a rat. In fact, his family members find it really quite crazy and don't approve. But he has encountered a figure with the marvelous name of Auguste Gusteau, proprietor of a 3-star, Michelin-star restaurant in Paris, who also has a television show about cooking, which Remy watches surreptitiously in a neighboring cottage. And there he learns from Gusteau this beautiful motto, anyone can cook. And he realizes that maybe even a rat could cook. Now, interestingly, by the time the story begins, Gusteau is dead. He's died of heartbreak because a critic wrote a scathing review and one of his stars was taken away. And so Gusteau is very much this godlike figure in the story who is not really present in it as an ordinary sort of actor, though he does show up in a couple of interesting scenes. But he's this figure who gives Remy this idea of bringing fine cuisine to his fellow rats, of having them realize you don't have to live your life eating garbage. You could actually taste cheese and strawberries and so forth. The only problem is Remy's family are not his helpers. They're his opponents. His brother Emil is basically a total glutton, will eat anything, no discernment, no taste. His father is even more opposed to this project of Remy becoming a chef and introducing cuisine to Rakhine. His father has this wonderful line to all the little rats, shut up and eat your garbage, because his father doesn't see why any rat should care about fine food. That's a human thing. That's not a rat thing. And Act One always ends with what you'd call frustrated desire. The story of Act One is frustrated desire because Remy has no one to help him achieve this unlikely mission. How the heck can a rat become a chef? Not going to happen, especially when your whole family opposes it and thinks you're crazy. At the end of Act One, though, Remy is separated from his family. An unfortunate sequence of events happens. I won't go into that. But Remy's actually left all alone, and now he's in an even worse situation. And Act One always ends with the thing that you sought to have happen. It's never going to happen in the current situation. So if I had like ended up in Dallas and had no way to get here and had told you that I was at a total impasse rather than having a friendly agent nearby, then we might have had a more full story. Act One ends with frustrated desire. In Act Two, something interesting is going to happen. Remy doesn't have what he needs to live out this story. He's stuck. In fact, at the end of Act One in Ratatouille, he's all by himself in the sewers beneath the city of Paris, completely alone, completely helpless. So what needs to happen in Act Two is Remy actually needs something. He needs to receive something. So in Act Two, the subject of Act One becomes the receiver of Act Two. The protagonist of the story actually moves from that protagonist role of the one delivering the good to the one who actually receives something good. And so in Act Two, Gusteau, in his kind of godlike or ghost-like way, is going to arrange to provide Remy the opportunity to cook. How will that happen? Well, Remy stumbles upon Gusteau's old restaurant and, looking down from a skylight, sees this washerboy named Linguini, who we know, though not everyone in the story knows, is actually the illegitimate son of Auguste Gusteau, but is at the moment only working kind of cleaning up. And Remy and Linguini, through a funny sequence of events, form a relationship, an alliance, in which Linguini is going to give Remy the chance to actually cook in a two-star French kitchen. Something a rat could never do by himself, but it turns out that if the rat sits inside your toque, your chef's toque, and pulls on your hair in just the right way, he can get you to do the motions of cooking. And so they realize they can partner together. And now Remy has a shot. He's got a chance to actually cook in a French kitchen. Now, we're going to add in this act, so Linguini is going to be the one who provides that opportunity. Well, now Linguini is going to need a helper, and this comes in the form of a more senior chef named Colette, who very impatiently tries to show Linguini the sort of ropes of the kitchen as Remy looks on from inside Linguini's hat. So Colette's Linguini's helper, and of course Linguini has to have an opponent. And this opponent is Chef Skinner, the current proprietor of Gusteau's restaurant, a very alarming name for the owner of a restaurant, Chef Skinner. And Chef Skinner suspects that something's up. He actually suspects there's a rat in the kitchen, though he can't quite prove it, and he is absolutely out to frustrate Linguini's quest to cook in every way he can. And this is the basic drama of Act Two. You now have everything set up. If we can overcome this opposition, in other words, help has arrived. And this is what happens in Act Two. Help arrives for the original subject to receive what he needs to do what he was meant to do. What happens in Act Three? It's going to be the same structure. And this time we're going to start with Remy again. Remy's now going to be the subject. And to totally give away every story, in Act Three, he's going to get, in a way, what he wanted at the beginning. But now he has the supporters that he needs. But a couple interesting things are going to happen. This original mission, same as Act One, is going to be played out. Remy may, in fact, get his whole family to like food and may get the chance to cook. He now has Linguini as a helper. He didn't have a helper before. Now he has a helper. He has the opportunity he needs. The only problem in, one more good thing. His family actually comes back into the story and decides they want to help. So his dad and Emil, his brother, and a very large, alarming number of rats join him in the kitchen to cook a meal. And if it doesn't make your skin crawl the first time you see it, I don't know, you've over-identified with the rats at that point, I guess. So the family actually become his helpers. And now he's got tons of people on his side. He can totally do what he's called to do. The only problem is there's opposition. There is, of course, Skinner, who's still around, still trying to frustrate this task, but there's more than that. It turns out that in the streets of Paris walks a figure named Anton Ego. Anton Ego, the fearsome restaurant critic whose scathing review robbed Gusteau's restaurant of its star many years before. And Anton Ego gets word of the alleged new chef in the place and decides that he's going to do a review. Now, already Linguini, with Remy in his hat, has become a very successful chef. Everyone's celebrating. And now it's time for the stakes to be raised. The stakes are going to get higher in Act 3. The job is going to get harder, and it gets harder when Anton Ego arrives. So let me show you what happens, a little clip from the film, when Anton Ego shows up at a little press conference that's being held by Linguini. So the stakes have been raised. It's not just a matter of finding a way to cook. It's not just a matter of overcoming even Chef Skinner, as frightening as he is. Now Anton Ego is on the scene. I will return tomorrow night with high expectations. Peter O'Toole's magnificent voicing. And Anton Ego says something very interesting in this little scene. Did you catch it? He says, you're new to this game. And Linguini says, game? What are you talking about? He says, yes. And you've been playing against an opponent, which, as you may have guessed, is against the rules. What rules? The rule of story. A fundamental rule of story is without an opponent, the story doesn't matter. You have to have an opponent. You have to have a strong enough opponent. Chef Skinner is kind of a trivial opponent. Every story at its climax in Act 3 has to bring our hero, the subject of the story, face to face with the greatest, deepest opposition. And without the greatest, deepest opposition, it's going to eventually be a kind of flat, disappointing story. So all the great stories have great opponents. Because without a great opponent, you're not really playing by the rules of narrative. I want to talk a little later about how this applies to how we tell our stories, but let me just pause right now and say that one of our temptations, I think, as Christians telling stories, is to be too nice in how we depict the opposition that we're up against. We tend to flatten out our stories. We make the stakes smaller rather than greater, and we don't take our stories to this third act climax that really shows what is really at stake and where is the opposition in the part of the world that you're addressing and that your mission addresses, and do you talk about it? Now, this can be tricky because you may know the names of those opponents and you don't necessarily want to, you know, identify them. Maybe you are actually working in a gang-infested neighborhood, and you know the names of those gang leaders. Now, I'm not saying whether it's a good idea or not to put them in your next documentary video about your ministry, but somehow you've got to signal to anyone who cares about your story the depth of the opposition to the work you're trying to do. Otherwise, it's not a true story. And often we kind of soft pedal the opponent. Not the great stories. Certainly not Lord of the Rings. I mean, my goodness, Mount Doom is about as good as it gets as an opponent, and the Eye of Sauron and so forth, right? So what we've got at the climax of Act 3 is a worthy opponent, Anton Ego, with some helpers, and everything hangs on the question of who's going to prevail. Now, in the movie Ratatouille, an amazing thing happens. And it really, this is part of why it's in my top five movies. It's about the power of beauty to transform someone. And now I'm really going to spoil the movie for you, so like cover your ears and say blah, blah, blah as I talk if you don't want to know. But Anton Ego comes the next night, full of bile and eager to critique with his pen in his hand. And he served ratatouille, the dish, the peasant dish, not a traditional fine cuisine dish, but made in such an exquisite way that he takes one bite, and then there's this beautiful flashback scene in which we see a little Anton Ego, like 8 years old, who's just broken his bicycle, and he's crying, and his mother serves him this little dish of rustic ratatouille, and at this moment, we see his heart melting, and we come back to the present, and he's actually swallowing and enjoying and tasting, maybe for the first time in his whole adult life, something that just brings him life and love. And in this great homage to 2001, the pen just drops from his hand in slow motion and eventually clangs on the carpet. And Anton Ego is no longer the critic. He's a little boy who's tasted something that reminds him of love. It is the laugh out loud, stand up and cheer moment in the movie, because something very profound happens at this moment. Anton Ego, who has been the opponent, the ultimate opponent, actually becomes an ally, becomes the helper. Now, that was a very expensive animation, so let me just show it again, right? Right? This thing, when the one who had been the most fearsome opponent becomes your greatest ally, because the next day he writes this glowing review, beautifully, one of the amazing things about Pixar, right, is they break every possible rule in filmmaking for children. Like, for example, do you think it would be a good idea at the climax of Act 3 in your children's film to have a roughly 2-minute monologue on the role of the critic in kind of aesthetics? I think you would decide that would not be something you put in your children's film, and that's exactly what goes in it at this moment. As Anton Ego reflects as a kind of reborn person, I mean, he's literally been born anew, and he rethinks what is it to be a critic. It's not just to tear things down. It's actually to advocate for what's really good in the face of indifference. And it's this beautiful, like, moment of aesthetic theory in a Pixar film that is also just incredibly heartwarming, because the one who we most feared is now the most on our side. And of course, now the restaurant is going to do incredible business, right? It's the conversion of the opponent that makes the story so powerful. I'll say a little more about that in a moment. Let me just mention a couple other features of the ending of Act 3 of this movie. It turns out that Remy's original dream was too small. Remy's original dream was just convince his family to eat decent food and let him cook. So he wanted to bring cuisine to rat kind, right? But by the end of the movie, Remy, the rat, is the chief chef in a kitchen that's feeding human beings. I mean, it doesn't make sense, except in a movie. But what is this in the frame of the movie? It's this vastly expanded happy ending, much happier than you could have anticipated. You could have imagined at the beginning of the movie that somehow Remy would find a way to be a chef. But could you really have imagined that he'd be the proprietor of the greatest restaurant in Paris, not feeding just his fellow rats, but all of humankind, food, you know, really worthy of the name? And the other thing that happens, I'll talk about that in a moment, is just to say about Skinner, he gets bound and thrown into the outer darkness in the form of a walk-in refrigerator. And so the other opponent is dealt with kind of decisively. So the first component of Act 3 is raise the stakes. The second component is the happier ending. This is what makes great stories. They have an ending that is happier than you ever could have imagined at the beginning. Now, this is another limitation, I would say, of many of the stories our organizations and institutions often tell. We set up a very simple conflict in the first minute of our fundraising film. We show you how our organization is solving it. And then at the end, we find, oh, sure enough, that simple conflict has been resolved. But that's a happy ending, not a happier ending. Great stories have happier endings than you could have imagined. And it's a great art, and it's not easy to figure out what would be the thing that you never could see coming, and at the end you're like, oh, this is what it had to be all along. This is how good it had to be. The happier ending is what makes a story really great. So let me go back to, I want to talk a little more about Ego. Ego. Anton Ego. Why is he named that? Well, Anton is pretty obvious. He's the antagonist, right? He's the opponent. It's literally the root, the Greek root for opponent. But why is it Anton ego? And I think this is actually the secret of the power of this moment in the film when Anton ego converts from critic or opponent to ally or supporter or helper. He's actually us. Who is your most fearsome critic? Especially if you're a creator, especially if you're some kind of artist. It's yourself. It's your own inner voice. It's your ego, right? That voice inside you that says, this is not good enough. That says, I don't like food, I love it, and if I don't love it, I don't swallow, and I'm not swallowing what you're making. I wrote a book that was published in 2008 called Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling. And it was about how Christians could be more active in making and in contributing something to the world. And thank you to those of you whose institutions like buy this in large quantities. We're very grateful. And I highly recommend it. I signed the contract for that book in 2004 with a delivery date of January 31st, 2005. 1 year to write the book. That's a typical length for a contract. On January 31st, 2005, it was a 100,000-word book, theoretically. I had 3,000 words. And the reason was my inner critic. Every time I would sit down to write, and by the way, this year that I had to write it, I was unemployed. I had nothing else to do than write a book, which turns out to be the worst thing possible for an author. Like, never trust an unemployed author. They will not get anything done. It's much better to be busy. But I was not busy. And day after day, I would sit and I'd stare at that blank screen. Now, my inner critic had a very specific voice. It was the voice of a prominent sociologist who I feared would, if I ever actually wrote this thing, read the book years later whenever it came out and sort of flip through it and say, this is stupid. And I literally thought about this individual who is a real person, thinking that through and maybe saying that in a review. And that, combined with my inner critic, paralyzed me for a year. Now, the really interesting thing is, actually, a number of years after that book came out, that very person wrote a book in which he spent three pages on my book and said, condensing from sociology speak, this is stupid. So actually, the very thing I feared, literally, I could not have scripted more exactly how it came out. And when it actually happened, years after all this fear of it, I was just like, why was I so worried about this? It's just one sociologist, right? One very powerful sociologist with powerful friends who could destroy my career. But other than that, no, it was not a big deal because it wasn't really ever about him. It was about what was inside me. And what we all want to believe is that that inner critic could become our best ally. That voice inside you that says you're not good enough could actually become your friend and spur you to be better. That knowing that you need to please that voice in a way, but knowing that that voice is on your side would call you to acts of great creativity you couldn't muster any other way. And I only really got going on writing that book when two friends of mine sat down with me behind a potted plant in a conference center in St. Louis, Missouri, and prayed over me and prayed over all this fear. And I think there was also, to be honest, some demonic elements to that. I hope that doesn't freak you out, but I think there was really some demonic things going on. And in that half an hour of prayer, I was delivered from that fear. And then it still was really hard work to write the book. And I turned it in 2.5 years late. But ever after that prayer, that inner critic was my ally, pushing me to do something better, rather than my opponent telling me I'd never be any good. What are the keys to a great story? Some of these I've gone over, but let me just sum it up this way, and then we'll come back to this afternoon and kind of keep going on it. What are the keys to having this happier ending? Well, you have to have had a phrase I've borrowed from the medical doctor and researcher Jon Kabat-Zinn. You have to have the full catastrophe. That is, great stories don't just play around. They don't just operate on the surface. They don't just give you a little problem. They take you to the heart of the full catastrophe of what it is to be a human being. I learned this phrase from Jon Kabat-Zinn when my wife was pregnant with our first child, Timothy. And along with the pregnancy came sciatica, the nerve-originating pain that's experienced as pain in the leg, but comes from your back. Excruciating pain for my wife, Catherine, day after day. And when you're pregnant, your options for pain relief are quite limited. You can't take drugs to relieve it. And so we were 3 months in when the sciatica hit. And it was 6 months of excruciation for my wife and in an indirect way for me. And the only thing we found that would help was a set of meditation techniques devised by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who studies chronic pain and its management without drugs. And the fascinating thing is the essence of the technique you learn from this system is how to actually focus on the pain as it's happening to you. It turns out that when you have intense pain, that the only way to bear it is not to try to distract yourself from it, but actually to completely attend to it. And all of our instincts when we're in pain, whether it's physical or psychological, emotional, spiritual, is to divert ourselves from it. That actually makes it worse. And Jon Kabat-Zinn says you have to face the full catastrophe. All those fears that come with that pain, all the physical discomfort, you've got to actually focus your attention on it more keenly than you've ever focused on anything before. And if you can learn to do this, you actually can learn to bear it. Every great story focuses our attention on the full catastrophe of being human. Doesn't let us pretend that it's not as bad as it is. It's hard to be a human being. And the great stories give us permission to attend to it. Another element of great stories, which I actually want to bring up to say why we need to be a little wary of this, is we really want to know that the ultimate opposition in the world will be banished from the story. We want to know that evil will be overcome. And in the story of Ratatouille, which is after all just a children's film, evil is kind of personified by the Chef Skinner, the opponent who's never going to become your helper. He's never going to help you. He's not going to be your ally. And so instead he has to literally get bound and tossed into the walk-in refrigerator. They do disclose in the script that he's released later on for, you know, in case any five-year-old asks about that. But in the frame of the story, evil is just cast into the outer darkness. And if we don't have this hope, then I think we really are in a catastrophe. But we do have this hope as Christians, right? The only problem is we are not allowed, I don't think, to tell this story within our human frame. I hope I can say this in a way that is clear, because I'm just thinking about it these days. Every community desires to hear that evil can be banished. The only problem is all the evil that is most salient and matters the most for us is actually the evil inside us. And the quest to tell a story about your community in which evil will be banished within the frame of our time and space rather than God's great redemptive frame actually leads to scapegoating people who themselves are opponents, possibly, but also have elements of the good and even could be our helpers and our allies. And so it leads to this kind of scapegoating response of saying, here's the evil. If we will only banish this from our community, we'll have the good result we seek. And the most powerful example of this in terms of storytelling is the amazing, technically excellent storytelling of Leni Riefenstahl, filmmaker to Adolf Hitler, in which a story was told that says, we know how to banish evil from the Aryan nation. I don't think, except in worship and in Christian prayer, devotion, and rehearsal of our story, I don't think we get to tell that story of the banishment of evil. Though I will say, there's a place for celebrating the times when our human justice systems actually do restrain violence. And maybe I'll come back to this afternoon. There's a place for it. But mostly what we need is the conversion of the opponent. What would it look like in the area where you work for the people and in a way the forces that are most deeply in opposition to true flourishing to actually be converted into helpers and allies of the true life that Christ came to give us? This is an essential element of great stories. What would that be? Do we have faith enough to believe that the people we currently see as our opponents could become our allies? And do we have faith to believe that our own internal opposition could become allyship as well? All right, I'm almost done with this part, but let me just say there's one more thing that happens in the best stories, and you could call it all things new. In the best stories, in the most kind of paradigmatic stories, the stories that set the pattern for all of those stories, at the end, things are genuinely remade, and I don't know any better version of this than this one. Then I saw a new heavens and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them, and he will be their God, and they will be his peoples. God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." And the one who was seated on the throne said, "See, I am making all things new." This is the horizon our late modern story impoverished world does not have. It is the horizon we have. It can allow us, it should allow us, to be the ones who tell our own world the very best stories. Let's learn to do that together. Thank you so much for your time and attention this morning.